I'm going to be speaking with Claire Dieterer, who's the author of a best-selling memoir, Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses, which has impressively been translated into 12 languages. And the book we're going to talk about today, though, is Love and Trouble, A Midlife Reckoning. And the first thing I wanted to mention and then have you read just a little bit to sort of orient the listener as we talk about what you cover in this memoir. I was flipping through Poser, and I saw this section that talked about the era when you were, I guess, in your 30s, and women were preoccupied, the women that you knew, with raising the best baby.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me as a really great companion piece to the section I'm going to ask you to read.
Because I never thought of that, but that's true.
Isn't that true?
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I think you have a fantastic skill at is doing a kind of collective reckoning, if you will, with the zeitgeist of what you're going through and recognizing it in the people around you. So when you were raising your baby in Poser, and the women were very intent on being the best at it, you really picked up on that thread. But there's another thread now, I guess, would be, 10 years later?
Yeah, I'd say about that.
With Love and Trouble, that you're picking up on. And it has to do partly with women weeping. So if you would, read a bit from the chapter called A Geography of Crying.
I would be happy to. Thank you. Okay, we'll start here. Even in public, the women wept unrestrainedly and loudly, not because they lacked social skills or because they were emotional exhibitionists. They cried like this because they'd been crying for so many months now that it just came real natural to them. Crying was simply what they did when confronted with a sympathetic face and perhaps a question of probing acuity, such as, how are you doing? A was doing that kind of crying right now. She was a spectacle. We were on a walk around the crest of Queen Anne Hill, not far from where Jay and I like to go for coffee. Clearly, there was a largish crack in Seattle's emotional stability on and around Queen Anne Hill. The early spring air smelled of Daphne Odora. We were the kind of women who know stuff like that, in Latin yet. A and I were on a crying loop, circling the hilltop. We marched like anchorites around the neighborhood, and A cried extravagantly. Where J leaked, A stormed, all elbows and knees, raging around the crying loop like she was getting in a workout. A was a person of tomboyish glamour, and people watched us as we went. Bastards, she railed, enumerating the sins of her hard-hearted ex-lover. It was the usual boring sociopath litany. It was just that A hadn't encountered it. I hadn't encountered it since we were in our 20s. It was intolerable, and yet she was tolerating it, but only through this lavish crying. I knew this was going to happen, she said. I wasn't sure what she was talking about, but that was okay. She was feeling betrayed in general. We all were, even though we weren't sure exactly why.
Mm. So tell us why the women are crying, why you're crying, and why the women are crying.
Well, I think that I spend about 250 or 300 pages trying to answer that question in this book.
All right, sum it up right now in 2 seconds.
So when I was in my early 40s or mid-40s, somewhere around there, I was overcome by a sort of gigantic melancholy that was undeniable. It was something that just came out of, kind of roared out of nowhere, and I didn't understand it, and it took hold of me. And it was lonely and upsetting and scary, and even though it was lonely, I was able to sort of peek around in the midst of it and see that other women around me were experiencing it. And I think that there are several reasons that this comes along in the 40s, though I don't want to generalize based on an age. I think that I'm about to, even though I just said I don't want to. I feel like it has to do with this recognition that the end is coming, that, you know, that this one part of life of sexuality and childbearing is wrapping up, and we can kind of see what's on the horizon, which is the end. I think that that's a big, lofty abstract rationale for what I experienced, but I think it's probably true. And for me, it was also accompanied by a very intense, renewed sexual yearning. And I felt really isolated in this as a reader. For me, one of the things that is just part of my life is if I'm going through something, I want to see that experience reflected in literature. And when I went to read both nonfictional and fictional works about this weird twinning of midlife melancholy and midlife sexual resurgence, I could not find it anywhere. Or if I did find it, it was immediately chalked up as the literature of menopause.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't going through menopause for starters. And for, you know, also I felt like men go through this. Men go through this incredible experience of perceiving their own mortality. And when men have written about this, it's basically all of 20th century literature. I mean, you know, Richard Ford and Philip Roth and all kinds of people have written about the dying male animal.
Yes.
But when women write it, it gets put in this bin of hormones, of menopause. And that's not what I wanted. That's not what was happening to me. When men have this experience, it's a universal human experience. It's big. It's existential. When women have it, it's like, yeah, take a hormone, right?
I had the same feeling when reading your book, which was that I'd been just grew up reading Mailer and Philip Roth and all these people, and like elaborate odes to their preoccupations with sexuality at a variety of ages. And yet I don't feel, you know, yes, there was a Fear of Flying, Erica Jong, you know, things like that. But they don't have the same. It's not like women haven't written about sex. But there is, I think, a particular aspect to women's sexuality and also adolescent yearning and awakening or whatever words. We'll talk about that later. That yeah. is different. And I don't feel like I had been reading about it that much either. So I felt very gratified to see this, and I felt gratified and sort of validated that you went and got out during these couple of years that you call a season in hell, when you're really feeling wretched and the women are crying, you know, and your friends are crying with you, and you take out your diaries from when you were a teenager. And the book has some excerpts of those diaries. And you refer to her as, I think, that horrible girl.
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I knew what you meant. But maybe you could talk a little bit about why you call her that horrible girl.
Well, just on the, you know, have you ever read your old diary?
To full disclosure, this is part of what was so heartening about your book. I'm working, I know I'm not supposed to talk about this because I'm interviewing you, but I'm working.
No, go.
You sure? Okay. So I'm working on an experimental audio podcast that's a memoir called 10 Days in Newark. And it's about my 16-year-old self. And I mean, I have to say, Claire, when I saw that you were rereading your stuff, because I got out the photos and I got out the diaries, and I nearly had a breakdown every night trying to remember more, because it's about a specific period with first love, first heartbreak, etc. And you're much more frank and disclosing than I think I'm going to be able to be. But
well,
anyway.
And audio is different than.
Audio is different. But yeah. Yes, I got them out, and I'm an idiot in the diaries.
No, it's excruciating.
Oh my God, obsessional? Oh.
Yeah.
Idiot. Not as smart as I thought, you know? And
right. Like maybe you were, I mean, you grew up to be interested in writing and you grew up to become a writer, so you maybe were facile with words. But I mean, just the emotional intelligence of somebody that age, I mean, they're just a moron. Certainly I was.
And yet, when we think of ourselves as, quote, that girl, man, there's a sense of loss.
Yeah, I think that...
For a lot of people.
Loss is a good word. I think that what happened with this book was I began writing really almost compulsively about my own sexual coming of age. That's how the project started. It actually had a step before that, which we can get into later. But I started writing about my own coming of age, and I, in general, am not a fan of coming of age memoir. I find it static. It's mm-hmm. just not for me. And so it was sort of a couple of years of this, and I started to wonder, well, why am I doing this? Why am I sort of committing myself to a form that, as a reader, I'm not a huge fan of? And I realized it was because I had sort of become that girl again. As a young person, I was obsessive. I was deeply melancholy, and I was sexually ridden. I often describe myself as more of a boy than a girl in the way that I was sort of led around by my dick. And I had a lot of those same feelings again in my 40s. I was experiencing a lot of those same things, and I sort of hadn't recognized that there was this twinning that had happened between the person I had been as a young girl and the person I had become in my mid-40s. And so I think that I was motivated to go back and look at the diaries because I was sort of becoming a moron again. You know, I think that after all these years of being a good wife and a good mother and a good worker and a critic, somebody who was a thinker and driven by her brain, this former self, I like this word we've hit on, this moronic self sort of came out of nowhere and enveloped me. Does that sound familiar at all?
Oh, so completely. And even, you know, I've noticed that in reviews of your book, which have been very positive and great, but people have responded to your memoir sometimes as being, I've seen these words, subversive, or they'll use the word radical. And I wonder why that is. I have one thought, and then maybe you can talk about whether you agree that it's subversive and radical, and whether you realized that while you were writing it. But one of them we said, which is that we're mostly used to reading the male voice about this. But I think you're incredibly candid about the girl and the woman enjoying being objectified. And I think as feminists, we are not really supposed to admit that. But I think as you get older, you might find yourself missing it at certain points in life. And I think you're very there about it. You're very right there about wanting to draw the attention of boys. And that it was to attract, maintain, and indulge the male sexual attention, no matter what, right?
Yeah, I think that that's very true, but it's not. And I think that, it's a strongly feminist book, and I think that I'm always interested in complications and reversals, and I think that I don't want to be the kind of feminist who can't acknowledge that kind of sexual desire.
Yeah.
If I can't, I want to be able to acknowledge that I need that kind of male attention. That said, I'm just remembering now, I gave the book to a friend who's a very, very good editor, and we were working on developing the through line, and she said, oh, well, the whole book is really about your need for male attention. And I was like, oh, God, really? That's just like, and it felt like the truest thing that had been said about my book. And it was so painful. And I think, one thing about writing your second memoir, which is just a hideous thing to do, but one thing about returning to memoir is that writing the first one, you have this experience of saying something really difficult or uncomfortable and feeling really exposed and feeling like an unsureness as to whether or not the reader will relate to it, or, you know, send the, you know, man from the loony bin with a giant butterfly net. And when you publish, then what inevitably happens is the moments in the book that are the most difficult to write, or that are talking about the most uncomfortable material, are the aspects of the book that people are most grateful for. So when people come up and cry and hug you and, you know, thank you for writing the book, they're not thanking you for writing the sunny sections or the intellectual sections. They're thanking you for writing those visceral truths. So coming to this book, I had that experience under my belt, and I was able to, when I saw something like that, like the difficulty of admitting my need for male attention, I knew that it was my job as a memoirist to go toward it, that was the very point of the exercise, because that's the place where the reader finds comfort and sustenance. And that's the place where memoir becomes generous and not narcissistic. That's why you do it. And so when my friend said that, my editor friend said that about the male attention, you know, I was like, oh, I don't want to write about this. This is totally humiliating. But I see it now, and I'm going to bring it forward as the theme of the book. But at the same time, I just want to say that it's not just something as sort of surface level as I want to be a feminist, and at the same time I crave male approval. There's something a little bit deeper going on, where this character, me, as a young girl, had male attention visited upon her in a way she didn't necessarily want. So embedded in this whole dialogue is a deeper understanding that women, that I had been objectified as a child by an older person, and that's buried in there somewhere as well.
Exactly. So much to respond to there. You know, I read recently that Roxane Gay wrote the book Hunger. She said something like, if I thought that anyone was reading anything I was writing, I would never write it. I mean, that's yes. Her approach. That's her approach.
I have to say, there's definitely a kind of, you know, like Buster Keaton teetering between those two points of view when I'm writing. Like, I have to sort of right. blindly go forward and pretend no one's going to see it.
Yeah.
But that, you know, because otherwise I could never write any of this stuff, pretend my parents are dead, you know, just assume yes. that no one's going to see it so that I can yes. get at that hard stuff and say it. But then when I guess I'm talking about a time a little bit further along in the process where you're like, oh, do I really want to publish this? And, you know, I've read Hunger and the, you know, those hard, hard things that she says in that book. They're so comforting and useful to me. And so there, you know, it's that moment when you're realizing like, okay, I did that part where I wrote as though no one was going to read it. And now I have to make decisions.
An author I spoke to recently, hilarious comic and also very candid, Samantha Irby, wrote this book.
I love Samantha
right?
Irby. It,
this book yeah. is We Are Never Meeting in Real Life and, yeah. and other essays. And she, too, I would link you and her, although the books are extremely different. I think there's a, I don't want to say the word trend, but I've been noticing something that I'm trying to keep an eye on in a critical, you know, critically analytic way. Like, why is this? What's going on? Like, I feel like memoirs are going further in being more candid and more honest. And I don't know if this is a theory that will hold up, but there's a little collection of a few that I feel that way about that. And I felt that way about yours and about Irby's. And I had that same feeling with hers. I think you hit it exactly. Not watching or reading narcissism, but a kind of gratification. It's almost like you're the, forgive me, sacrificial lamb who's, you know, willing to boldly go where I can't go, or I think
well,
I can't
go.
Well,
I think, that, you know, not long after I published, somebody wrote something on Facebook where they said, thank you so much, you know, you're standing naked in the town square.
Oh, my goodness.
And I do think there is a misapprehension about women's memoir that it's not constructed. So we're talking about honesty, and we're talking about saying really difficult things, but it's all structured within, it's built into a book, into a piece of art. And for me, I was very happy at the end, because this book took me a really long time, with how I had constructed it, how the formal elements came together to suggest this, you know, this both the moving back and forth in time, but also this patchwork construction of identity. There were elements of the structure of the book that I worked really hard on, and that I felt, because it's so structured and it has so much formal play, I felt that the honesty of the book and the difficult things I say in the book were really held by that structure. And, you know, it's there's a way that memoir sometimes gets talked about, that it's like, you know, this, when we talk about honesty, it starts to sound like this sort of gushing flow of journaling.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not at all what has happened here. I mean, this is a 70,000 word book, so a very short book, which I worked on for 6 years. So it's a made thing. And in that sense, you're not vulnerable. You've managed, and same thing with Samantha Irby.
Hmm.
You know, you've managed and structured this material into a form that you can be comfortable with. And another thing I think that she and I probably share is this compulsion to go toward what is dark and uncomfortable, that is always done with humor.
Yeah.
And that is something I think we are seeing more and more of, especially as this more fragmented essay form becomes the norm in memoir. Not the norm, but people are playing with it more. I do feel like I'm seeing more humor in memoir, more overlap there. Thank God.
To go back to this notion of what you're after as a teenager and then longing for in midlife, you come to a point where you realize it's not that pleasure, the sexual pleasure itself, is not really the goal for you. It's more, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's more the power, the feeling of power that you might hold over the male, even though you do go into a very, very elaborate, either fantasy or truth, I think it's meant to be a bit ambiguous, depiction of what you would want done to you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I guess that's not really a question, but...
Well, thank you for understanding that passage is meant to be ambiguous.
Oh, good. Okay. I hoped I hadn't missed it.
No, that's a perfect reading of it. And there's been some misreadings, which is great. I wrote something that was ambiguous and it's been misread. That's how it's supposed to operate. But I think that the book does deal with this issue of wanting to have things done to you. And it deals with this idea of this character, me, feeling empowered by that. And I'd say there's sort of a question at the heart of the book, which is whether there's, I talk about wanting it and liking it and how difficult that is for me.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the issue of the book is, like, as a girl and then as a woman, there's a problem in acknowledging that you want to have sex. It feels uncomfortable. And the book sort of builds toward that idea that just to say I like it and I want it is one of the hardest things. I say a lot of difficult things in the book. That's the hardest thing that I say in the whole book. And so having something done to you, being in some way somewhat, you know, made to do something, is a way of disowning the responsibility for one's own sexuality.
I'm literally chewing on that. Yeah.
Okay, well, how about it?
Done to you. Do you mean it sort of takes away, is it dissociating?
No, I don't think it's dissociating, because if I were... dissociating would suggest an absence of pleasure.
Okay.
And one of the sort of cardinal things about me as a character in this book is that I like it. So dissociation would mean something different. I think it has more to do with agency. Here's a person who wants to be in a situation of having sex and doesn't want to be in charge of making that happen. And that's sort of what the whole culminating chapter of the book on victimhood is about. When I was a child, I was forced into a sexual situation. Not a big deal, but it did happen to me. And as an adult, I like the feeling of being dominated or, you know, being overwhelmed by a man. And the book is asking the question, are those two things connected? Did the desire to be dominated grow out of the experience of having been forced as a little kid?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a really uncomfortable question. But I think what I come to in the book is this idea of we don't get to choose our circumstance as children or even as adults. I mean, historical circumstance and cultural circumstance drives everything I write about, actually, as you said at the beginning of this interview. And so I'm talking about how as a kid, something happened to me. I didn't get to choose that experience, but as a very sexually driven person, I construct my sexual life from what I'm given. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. What I'm kind of flashing on is a film, Things Behind the Sun. Did you see that?
I don't know this.
Okay. So I think it comes from a novel, and my apologies to the author for not remembering her name, based on a true story, and a woman who has been raped, which is, I should say, not what happens to Claire. This is not what Claire is talking about, and we're not in any way, minimizing that brutal act. That is not what happens. But she goes to confront it was a couple of boys in her hometown. I mean, it's quite amazing. And she says something because in her adult sexual life, she enacts certain familiar tableaus. And she uses this phrase, you all have colonized my desires. And that kind of blew me away.
Yeah, I think that that's really beautifully articulated. And then what happens? The question is, I think of Love and Trouble is sort of like, then what happens to you? Mm-hmm. Here's this person who's been molested as a child and craves the male gaze. Okay, you know, has been colonized or occupied by this need to please men. All of that's happening. Great, fine, whatever. This is a very, very, very common story, which I'll return to in a second. But what do you do then? You still have a sexuality. You still have to figure out how to navigate it. So the book asks, well, how did I do that? What happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you do use a phrase that we use in the psychotherapy biz a lot, which is a hypersexualized, which is that after some trauma, and there's what we call kind of big T trauma and small T trauma.
Right. This is, again, small T trauma.
Although, I think that enough small T traumas in a continuing, unrelenting way almost equal big T. And, it shouldn't be a competition, but at any rate, that after some sort of unwanted or unsolicited sexual advances, no matter how you feel during them, by the way, which is a whole other topic for another time, can either lead to someone shutting down sexually and withdrawing and protecting themselves. I mean, look at what Roxane Gay talks about after a horrible thing, gaining more and more and more and more weight as a shield.
Yeah.
Or there's the hypersexualization, which I think you identify more with in terms of where you went as that horrible girl, that teenage slut. These are your words, right.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that it's normal from a therapeutic point of view. Reading the Roxane Gay book, and we don't need to talk about hunger the whole time, but
no.
I did think about the Laura Kipnis book, The Female Thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Laura Kipnis is a writer who's really important to me, who influenced me, and who I was lucky enough to have review me in The Atlantic, which was like a dream come true. I think she's an incredibly interesting thinker on sexual politics. She has this incredible passage, throwaway passage in The Female Thing, where she talks about, which is a book just about constructions of femininity, where she talks about how In male literature, there's a crucible narrative that is the narrative of war. Mm. That there's this idea of male personhood that grows out of the experience of war. And she says that for women, rape or sexual violation is a similar crucible. And if we could own those narratives the way men have owned war narratives, we'd give rise to a new, I don't think she says this, but there's sort of implied that there would be a new kind of women's literature that would arise.
Wow.
And I thought of that constantly as I was reading those really difficult passages in Hunger. And I thought about it as I was writing my, you know, much more no big deal molestation thing scene. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to talk about that idea of small T trauma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that less, that idea that there's different levels of trauma, or are we co-opting the dialogue if we're talking about a less big deal?
And, right.
You know, I talk about that in the book. I say, don't all these no big deal moments sort of add up to a big deal.
Oh, you do. And that's right. Mm-hmm.
And it's not just in my own life, but it's this idea that as that was happening to me when I was a preteen, you know, in a far distant corner of Washington State, that something was happening to other girls in the dark all across the country. And I had this image as I was writing of myself alone on this island with being touched in a way I didn't want to be touched. And this idea of all these girls not knowing about each other, having something similar happen from a mom's boyfriend or a youth group leader or an older brother's friend, or all these no big deal moments happening at the same time. Because if you talk to any woman my age, they have a story about being pawed or kissed or whatever. And for me, I think that that's one thing that's been incredibly moving about the election of Trump, was the release of the Access Hollywood tape and what happened after that. You know,
yes.
I saw the Access mm-hmm. Hollywood tape. I watched it over and over and over and over and compulsively. And I didn't realize he was talking about assault. I didn't take it in. I was just horrified. It was mm-hmm. sort of I was almost not in a non-thinking state. And it took a man, some pundit, to say, hey, he's talking about sexual assault. And I sort of woke up and thought, he is talking about assault. And this is the kind of assault that has happened to me many times.
Yes.
And the thing that happened next was that Kelly Oxford, who's a writer, went onto Twitter and said, please tweet to me your first assault.
Hmm.
And she did it on that Friday when the Access Hollywood tape was released. And the thing that was so great about what she said, the word first implies a list, mm-hmm. which is what every woman
lives
with.
Yes,
or most women. Some women are lucky. And so she thought she'd get a few responses. By midnight that night, I think she had a million responses. And for me, as somebody who was completing this book and getting ready to publish it, the vindication that these no big deal things were happening all around me, and that they had been big deals for women, they had been important experiences for women that shaped them sexually, it was an incredibly moving experience to see that happen.
Yeah, so I do remember that, and I was very, very moved by it. And you know, there's we're talking with Claire Dieterer about her memoir, Love and Trouble, A Midlife Reckoning. You know, you and I are different ages. I'm older than you. We're not going to say by how much, but because I'm a fool that way. I just don't want to. But
I like a little vanity. That's
right.
Good.
I mean, like, you know, God, how evolved do I have to be? So I really related to so much of it, even though we grew up in different eras. I mean, you have some great chapters about Seattle and like just your haunts and use of acid, ecstasy, feminism, all the things you were exposed to. So I grew up in the 60s. And one of the intriguing things about the 60s for women, and there has been a little bit written, is that there was a tremendous pressure for women to be cool, quote unquote, in the leftist hippie movement. And so you had a lot of sexual promiscuity and a lot of damaged women because of it. But similarly to how you looked at and how you refer to, like, oh, no big deal, no big deal, No Big Deal. I think we should co-write a book called No Big Deal. You know, and it would be these no big deals. Actually, you make a brilliant point about, you know, you stack them up. And this notion of no big deal is very complicated because it's so, I don't know, I guess each year is somewhat different in what's considered okay. But in general, I think one of the contributions your book makes is that these things are not so much talked about. And I think listeners might want me to ask you this, because I do a lot of interviewing of memoirists. And I like to ask them if there's anything, this comes back to an earlier thing about writing memoir, that's off limits. Because I've noticed that a couple of people have said, I won't write about my children, for example.
Yep.
Okay. In reading your book, Love and Trouble, clearly there is a lot exposed about your sexual life with your husband. I'm sure not everything. I'm sure of that. But again, because it's constructed, this is not, I don't want anyone to get the impression that this is just a tell-all diary. It is not. It is carefully constructed. So there's a lot about, you know, how to be, what's the name of that chapter? How to be married?
How to have sex with your husband of 15 years.
I mean, what, right there. Right there. You know, so there's a great section that I think people will enjoy about, you know, the getting started. You know, there is the new research, by the way, in sex therapy, that the old theory, and I'm going on a tangent, but of you need to feel an attraction to your partner and then you act on it, is being thrown out. Because after like 15, 20 years of cohabitation, it's not going to come that way. And as you put it in the book, you said there's some kind of surge of sexual yearning. I don't know what was your metaphor, or something like you could be ironing, or you could...
Right. It could be, I think it can be occasioned by thoughts of a stranger or an image of a glistening brown chicken in the Wednesday food section of the New York Times.
So brilliant. So brilliant. You know, the shape of something vague in the distance. And so you bring that yearning to the person. This is the new sex therapy thing. And then you say to them, are you willing? Are you
right? So it's like the old joke or the old saying of, it doesn't matter where you get the hunger as long as you come home to eat.
Oh, I never heard that. That's good. Oh, I think I know what you're talking about. Like where you do your eating or something like that.
Yeah.
But at any rate, so okay, back to the idea that you've talked about your husband and your daughter, who you depict in just such a beautiful way, really capturing aspects of adolescence, will potentially read this book. So I do need to ask you about that. You know, did you have your husband pre-read? Some people do that.
Yeah, so basically people want to know, what about my parents, what about my husband, what about my kids?
I didn't care about your parents.
Good, I like that.
Not at all. I didn't think about them once, by the way.
Interesting, because usually as a memoirist, that's the first question. What about your mom? I will tell, in case there's people working on memoirs listening to this, that in this particular case, I just pretended my parents were never going to read it.
Okay.
And then when the book came out, I had a brilliant flash of insight, just this brilliant idea, and I simply told them not to read it.
Would they obey? They would obey that.
Well, if they do, they are not going to tell me about it. So
good.
Perfect.
Nice. I like it.
I know. It's very simple. I'm very pleased with myself.
Good job.
Thank you. My husband did, of course. I mean, my husband's also a writer, a very accomplished writer and a very accomplished editor. So in general, we read each other's work as we go along. That's something we've always done. And then I started to write this book. And when I wrote this book, I was like a little kid in, you know, taking a test with their arm curved around their piece of paper. I really didn't want to show it to very many people. I showed it to Victoria as I worked on it, who's a big character in the book. She's my best friend. And the dynamic of adult female friendship is an important theme.
Oh, I'm in love with her, too, by the way.
She's so lovely. So I showed it to her and a couple other readers, but I didn't show it to anyone because I knew that we were talking about this idea of pretending no one was going to see it earlier, and I needed it to be just this sort of very top secret project in order to say what I needed to say. I always thought of it as growing mushrooms in the basement. You know, it was just secret. And that was a problem with my husband because I didn't show it to him till it was finally done. And there's a lot about him in there. And there's, you know, it's just, that was something that I should have shown him as I went along, but I just couldn't and complete the book. So it was interesting because nothing I said about him was a problem when he finally did read it.
Yeah.
But the not including him in my process was a huge betrayal to him. He was really upset by that. So that was an interesting thing. How do you write something that's difficult and private and still be in this partnership as two writers?
That is so fascinating.
Yeah.
It was the connection and the closeness and the inclusion that was the issue.
But this character is isolated and having her own experience outside her marriage. And, I mean, that's part of what is the portrait, I'm just realizing as I talk to you, is this person who's sort of been cast out from her marriage because she's so melancholy and so yearning for something else.
Well, you know something? Sometimes honesty is overrated. so that project I mentioned to you earlier, the audio memoir, I'm collaborating on it with my husband.
Oh, my gosh.
Right. Oh, my gosh. And it's about my first boyfriend when I was 16. And people say, like, what? How can you? What do you? What? So there is there's a certain, not everything is shared. Let's put it that way. Now, I mean,
yet I'm writing something that the whole world's going to see. So ultimately it's shared. I mean, that's the.
Well, what I mean is. Let's say this, you didn't include your husband in the process of writing.
Yes.
So, and then it's ultimately shared. And then there it is, it exists, it's got physical weight and life, and that's, you deal with that. But during the whole down the rabbit hole journey of my project, there's a lot I need to tell him that one could say, well, isn't that going to be hurtful? You know,
yeah.
I happen to have someone working with me and in my life who is or claims to be not jealous, not possessive. If it were me, there's no way I would kill. It's so hypocritical.
Oh, yeah, I'm a terrible person. Like,
yeah, I'm terrible that way. But there's this one point in the book where your husband does say, it's okay to have secrets, just be careful. And that just...
Isn't that beautiful?
It is one of the most beautiful marital statements I think I've ever read.
Yeah.
It's okay to have secrets, just be careful. I mean, I feel like he really, he may not have been in on the process, but he really, what do I know? I don't know your marriage. He gets you. You know, he somehow got that you were going through this. It's like a hero's journey. You had to, like, go into the desert. I mean, I imagine you tried to. Did you, during my project, I'm going to sleep at night trying to remember more. I have dreams about the era.
Yeah.
Thank you. You know, Mary Carr, who we both admire, she says in her book, The Art of Memoir, if you think you're going to have a nervous breakdown during the writing of the memoir, don't do it. You know, just don't go there. But sometimes you don't know ahead of time what it's going to be like.
Yeah, right. I think that that's true. And I think that what she might be pushing back against in that statement is this perception of memoir as a cathartic process. You know,
right.
I spoke earlier about how memoir is sometimes represented or perceived as being this sort of gigantic journaling project, where you're writing down all your feelings and then publishing them. And I think that another misperception that's tied to that of memoir is that you write it and then you feel better. Or you write it and you kind of...
You're transformed.
Extremely dark place, and the memoir is part of that process. And there may have been some of that with this book, but I would say in general, that dynamic is something that lends itself to bad art. Because if you're, I think that there is an element in which you're uncomfortable and it's difficult and you're suffering and, you know, you're having a nervous breakdown, as Mary Carr says, but then there has to be time to create the distance so that you're looking at it dispassionately and making a thing that will be something for an audience and not for yourself. And I think that's what she's really talking about, is the transformation of the material into something that's not for you. It's not for your experience. It's for a reader. It's for the audience. And that step is one of the most difficult things for beginning memoirists, that understanding that it's not about your own experience.
And another one is, this is a classic one, right, which is like, just because it happened.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Doesn't right, mean. I'm sorry to cut you off. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. What were you
saying? Oh, I was just going to say I could talk to you for another couple of hours, but the next show, you know, the Organic Farmers are here. It's so great.
Oh,
they
nice.
Have the show Organic
Farmers. Are they in their overalls?
They are, actually. And they always bring me, they talk about the sexiness of kale. It's really quite good. So, but I have one final question. We've been talking with Claire Dieterer, Love and Trouble, A Midlife Reckoning. And this interview, by the way, will be available to download as a podcast probably by tomorrow. I'll get it ready. Did you recover memories of any sort during this process? Because you had diaries. You had some documents that you could go to. Were there any things you didn't expect to remember that you did? Not necessarily sexual, but anything about that teenage girl?
I'm afraid that my experience was almost the exact opposite of that, that there were these memories that I held that were sort of canon about my own story, about my adolescence. Mm-hmm. And as I worked, I discovered more and more that there were wobbly bits. You know, I would start talking to people. Well, no, that cafe wasn't there, or that person didn't move to Seattle until 1986, or... So my own experience was destabilizing in terms of my own memories. And I don't know what to say about that, except for that I felt like I almost lost more memories. As I looked at them more closely, they slipped away from me.
Okay, that's got to be part two. We're going to have to talk again. Because we didn't, you know, we didn't really go into memory all that much. Well, you know, how much can one do in a... 45
minutes. Right, I think we covered a lot of ground.
But we did. We covered a lot of ground. We did.
Don't beat yourself up.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's very kind. Claire Dieterer, Love and Trouble, A Midlife Reckoning. Are you still on tour? Going anywhere?
I'm home. Oh. I'm going to Chicago. I'll be in Chicago at the end of September. And alas, I don't have my dates in front of me. But I'll be at Women and Children First in the last week of September. And I'm so excited.
And that is in Chicago?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So for our
I'll be talking with the great writer Kim Brooks. So I'm looking forward to that.
I'm expecting her memoir in the mail.
Mine just got popped in the mail this morning. I'm so excited.
Oh my gosh, you're going to get yours before me. Okay, Binnie, now just grow up. Okay, so we've been talking about going back in time. What can I do? So it's been wonderful to talk to you, Claire. Thank you so much for visiting WPKN and A Miniature World.
Thank you so much for having me. It was delightful.
Okay, you're very welcome. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.